Hello and welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Ben Rylan. On the show today, we'll be to-ing and fro-ing between the stage and screen as film critic Karen Krasanovich and theatre and comedy critic for The Times, Dominic Maxwell, join me here in the studio for a roundup of the week in both their fields. Elsewhere on the show, we'll be rocking out to some Turkish psych music with an author who's written a book about just that. And we'll head to Asia for this week's Global Countdown. That's all ahead on the Monocle Arts Review. Stay tuned. Dominic and Karen, welcome both to the show. We'll get started at the cinema, I think, with a rather topical film as we're wrapping up week one of the Winter Olympics, I, Tonya. Now, this follows the sad story of the disgraced American figure skater Tonya Harding. Karen, I'm sure most people know of Harding's downfall, but very quickly, recap the story for us.
I'm not sure everybody does, because actually Margot Robbie didn't realize it was a real story.
I was just thinking as you said that. I think a lot of people probably would know, but then Margot Robbie is quite young, so it might have skipped right over her head.
Okay, I believe it was in the 90s that there were many rival figure skaters, Tonya Harding and Nancy Kerrigan. And one was a bit of an underdog, a bit of a roughhouser, a sort of wrong side of the tracks. The other one was much more sleek and groomed and was loved more by the judges. And there was an incident where Nancy Kerrigan's knee was broken by a collapsible baton, apparently by a man that was hired by Tonya Harding's camp. And that is sort of the pivot of this story.
We'll discuss the dynamics at play in the film in a moment. I think perhaps first we should hear a clip, though.
When I was a kid, did you ever love me?
I made you a champion, knowing you'd hate me for it. That's the sacrifice a mother makes.
You cursed me. America, they want someone to love, but they want someone to hate. What kind of friggin' person bashes in their friend's knee?
Okay, so the tone of this film, I've heard, is somewhat unexpected. I had a friend who has managed to pop into a press screening, and she said she was quite surprised at the lighter tone that a lot of the film seemed to take.
Well, Craig Gillespie is an Australian director, took this on, and he's got quite a very interesting tone, a very tongue-in-cheek tone, and in a way, I don't want to say an Australian tone, but, you know, a real healthy sense of humor and approach to this. It's a dark comedy because there is a lot of punching, hitting, shooting. There's a lot of swearing. There's a little bit of knife throwing. It's a violent film about domestic abuse, about between mother and her child, about a woman and her husband. It's kind of frightening a little bit.
But I suppose the tones like this can work, but they can be difficult to really pinpoint, can't they? I mean, you look at a film like Gus Van Sant's film To Die For, which was a black comedy about someone
stalking.
Who is very, very violent and nasty, but somehow it works because you've got someone with quite a lot of talent at the helm. And I suppose the difficulty is that these sorts of films aren't for everyone. How did it come across to you?
Well, at first, because I've watched it twice, and at first I had to quit in the middle because I didn't get in with the pace of it. It's quite bouncy. It almost seems like an advertisement sometimes, and it's easy to say that because Craig Gillespie's made advertisements, but it's very sort of in your face. It starts off very quickly. Margot Robbie is amazing, and after a while, you begin to settle into this sort of this vibe. It's a period movie. It looks period. Allison Janney plays Tonya's mother, Lavona, I believe it's Lavona, who she can't speak without swearing, and she wants to make her daughter, who I believe was her third child or fifth child from her fourth husband? I can't remember that all, into this skating champion. And it starts off really quite heartbreaking because at the age of four, she was winning skating championships above older girls. And this is a girl that didn't have any money, who just loved skating. She loved it, but she was from the wrong wrong demographic for ice skating. Ice skating was supposed to be for ladies.
So how do the characters that are depicted here come off? Are they likely to be looking at this with all of its Oscar glory and be thinking, I'm glad that I'm finally back in the spotlight?
Toward the end of the film, they have real footage of what they used for reference. So they've got real Tonya skating. They've got her husband, Jeff Gillooly, her ex-husband, talking in a car. And you can see where they derived it. But no, these are heightened characters. We get the sense of their character, of their desperation, of their resentment, of how chippy they are, about what they want to achieve and how they're going to achieve it. There really is hardly a nice bone in anybody's body, to be honest. But you get into the rhythm of that, almost like, it's like a cheerful sort of deliverance on ice. They're kind of like, hey, we're really, really rough people, but we're all right.
A lot of Oscar talk surrounding this, and Margot Robbie is certainly on a fairly steady ascent to the top of Hollywood at the moment. How were your thoughts as you came away from watching this in its entirety? Is she about to be added to the gallery of Best Actress winners?
Well, she's headed into a very interesting leading character actress slot. But I think the real Oscar, I'd put money on this, is Allison Janney, Best Supporting Actress, because she's we see her with a parrot on her shoulder. That's the first shot we see pretty much when she's, current. And you think, wow, she can act with a parrot. No, really, seriously, they're very interesting, very strong female roles, but also technically, Margot Robbie actually skated, I think, 5 different skate routines for a minute each, and then the rest of it is doubles and a lot of very clever CGI and a heck of a lot of wigs. This is a real wig movie.
You shouldn't ice skate in wigs. You really shouldn't.
No, it's not a good idea.
I, Tonya is out today in cinemas across the United Kingdom. We'll come back to you, Karen, in just a few moments for another film pick. But just for now, we're off to the theatre, Dominic Maxwell, and we're heading to the Vaudeville. What do we find on the stage here?
We find the latest installment in the theatre's year-long season of Oscar Wilde. And although we got the sort of, when you think of Oscar Wilde in the theatre, it tends to be importance of being earnest, maybe sometimes an ideal husband. But actually this season is also putting on the lesser seen ones. There was A Woman of No Importance at the start of the season off, and that came across as a sort of Ibsen with giggles. And this is Lady Windermere's Fan, and this is sort of slightly similar. It's social issues, but it is also very much a comedy.
Now, everyone will be probably catching a glimpse of this if they're travelling around the Tube here in London, because the posters, of course, have the face of Jennifer Saunders all over them. Tell me a little bit about this.
Well, Jennifer Saunders is both, I think, the biggest reason to go and see this, and also a slight red herring. In that she's very much not the star. She is doing the sort of the Maggie Smith in Downton role. She is doing the Dowager Duchess. She's doing the upstaging. She does it brilliantly. She hasn't been on stage for 20 years. She comes on. There's so much potential just to camp this role up as the sort of dubious, haughty, one-liner trading elderly duchess.
One would imagine if there's that potential, she would be the one to really lap that up as well.
She absolutely seizes on it. But, she's such a good comedian. Every line, there's such intelligence behind it. She finds absolutely the most value from every line, but never caricaturing, always just taking it to the furthest degree of how funny you can make it, but stopping short of turning it into just a farce.
Tell me about, because you mentioned this is some of the lesser-known works. Mm. What is the value of seeing some of the lesser-known works of great writers when they're put back up on the stage? How do you see that? Because, as you say, there are a lot of opportunities to go and see the classics, as we know. Mm. What can you gain from going to see a lesser-known work?
Oh, well, I think this is a good play. I don't think it's as good a play as Importance of Being Earnest, or even An Ideal Husband, for that matter. And I think Kathy Burke directs, and her production doesn't quite convince that this is sort of a neglected masterpiece. It does entertain for 2 hours. She's cut it down a fair bit. I think it's interesting, and A Woman of No Importance for the same. I think because we associate Wilde with laughs, because Importance of Being Earnest is the most famous one, that is a flat-out comedy. To see him dealing with, let's call them, feminist issues in 1892, to see him, his empathy for people, for the sideline, really coming through, there's lots to like in here.
Oscar Wilde is someone who some people have said is the works of his works are a little bit like a very good wine. They age very, very well. In fact, they're better consumed now than they might have been during his time with us. What are your thoughts on that, Oscar Wilde as portrayed in today's age?
Ooh, well, it's an honest sort of period portrayal. They don't try and update it. Like I say, because of the feminist angle. I mean, the society angle is all very much of its time, but that's established well, and it's all about a woman risking disgrace in a way that, I'd like to say it's firmly rooted in that period. I don't think it is. I think it's about double standards between the sexes. So in that way, right now, in the Me Too moment, it comes out very strongly. And actually, what Kathy Burke has done, because Jennifer Saunders' character doesn't appear in the second half, she's written her a music hall number to sing between the acts called Keep Your Hands Off My Fan. And that is one of the highlights. That's brilliant.
So this is part of a year-long Oscar Wilde season. Is there any such thing as too much Wilde?
Not so far. 3 out of 3 so far, because there was also Simon Callow doing Wilde's monologue De Profundis, which is also a bit of a treat. So we'll see. I guess in a way the bigger challenge is coming to Importance of Being Earnest, and because that one is on sort of all the time. It's had 2 West End productions in the last 5 years. So, you know, what can they add to that one?
Oh, well, I'll just always mourn not ever being able to get to see Patricia Routledge perform that on stage in Melbourne. I just missed out. Lady Windermere's Fan is on at the Vaudeville Theatre here in London until April the 7th. Karen, any particular favourite Oscar Wilde adaptation for the screen?
Oh, gosh, that's a...
It's a wild card.
It is a wild one, yeah. I can't think of one right off the top of my head. I keep reaching for what the fan was symbolizing what?
Should we go into this?
Just very quickly, can you do it in a log line?
It is a plot point. Lady Windermere's Fan is found at another man's house.
Okay, that's enough.
I understand.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Like lipstick on your collar, I suppose.
Yeah, or car keys in a bowl. I get it. Maybe not.
All right. I think that's a completely different game. Back to the cinema we head now for Black Panther. Now, it's the latest superhero movie from Marvel that takes place in an Afro-futuristic utopian world called Wakanda. This is a superhero film, but I think as anyone who has caught a glimpse of this in the press might have caught on that, it's not just any superhero film. It's being touted as an absolute moment. Why is that?
People are saying meet the future. Well, because the African American and indeed global marketplace for non-white heroes, superheroes for that matter, is vast. And don't forget that Disney bought Marvel for $4 billion. They made this movie for $200 million. They put another $150 million into marketing. And they're looking at $170 million projected for the box office. Now, this film is opening globally pretty much this coming weekend. There is a lot of press and a lot of talk about it. And also, it's one of the largest pre-sold superhero movies in the history of superhero movies. So people are anticipating this because not only do we have a black director, we've got a nearly all-black cast. We've got Oscar-nominated Daniel Kaluuya in there. And we've got a story that people have been waiting for. Black Panther, whose real name is T'Challa, I'm trying to say that correctly, was created in 1966. He's had some bit parts here and there, but he actually came to our attention, I mean, filmically anyway, in 2016, Captain America Civil War. And I remember when he came on screen, everybody was going like, yes! I'm thinking, what am I looking at? And it was great because we were all waiting for this moment for a genuine black superhero who has dignity, poise, and everything every superhero has ever had, never sidelined, dignified, powerful.
Diversity seems to be really making a lot of headway in the superhero genre. There are a lot of doubts as to whether Wonder Woman would be able to conquer the box office, and they were, of course, all proven completely incorrect. Wonder Woman definitely succeeded, conquered everything. Now, this film, there'll be a lot of expectations about this now, simply because the buzz has become so loud. Are there any concerns that with so many high expectations, it might be creating a little bit of a wall that's a little bit too high to jump?
Well, I went to the European premiere, and it was very interesting. They had the cast there, which was really, really interesting. And For me, I thought the story could have been a little more cohesive. I mean, it's moralistically, it wanders a little. I couldn't really kind of track what it all was. But the women are ferocious and amazing. The costumes are pretty good. The design, I thought the rendering could be a little better. Don't forget, I work in the art department from time to time, so I think I know.
Speaking like a professional, I can hear it.
Speaking as a semi-professional, yes. But there are some real moments in this where it's funny. You know, it's like Iron Man funny.
Yeah, yeah. And really, that's what the Marvel superhero movies do so well. They have this amazing tone where you can get really serious and you can have a whole lot of punch-ups, and then someone's making a joke and it's genuinely funny.
And then you can talk about shawarma, you know, or whatever. And then there's... Okay, Letitia Wright plays Chala's sister. And she is sort of the Q to his James Bond. So she's designed all this really cool stuff, and it all contains vibranium, which is what keeps Wakanda going. It's like everybody thinks it's third world and really, really poor. It's not. It's a technological giant. And I keep thinking, I'm sure it was Zamunda. But of course, Zamunda is coming to America. No, don't do that. You know, there is an element here of Americans' idea of what Africa is. Not that I am au fait with Africa or America, indeed, right now. But I kept thinking, there was a heightened Marvel sort of lack of reality here, which I guess is why we go to the movies. But Letitia Wright is amazing, and there's this bit where she shows him this panoply of wonderful things that she's designed, and he goes, "What's this?" She goes, "No, you should say, what's this?" And we look down, and he's wearing really ugly shoes. So there's a moment. There are really lovely moments in this that will make you laugh.
Fantastic.
It's just a good movie.
Yeah. Let's hear a short clip from Black Panther.
We are home. My son, it is your time.
Show me my respect and bow down.
You get to decide what kind of king you are going to be. Don't freeze.
I never freeze.
Well, just finally on this, Karen, because I do want to just touch very briefly on the political aspect of this, because Lupita Nyong'o, who is also starring in the film, she told the BBC that the film is set in Africa and we meet an entirely new nation that the world has never been to, and it delivers on that feeling of being like in another world. It's a nation that is highly developed, and they are so because they didn't get interrupted by colonialism. It is going to be the unavoidable political angle on this film, isn't it? That it's depicting this alternate reality that people are really going to, the minds will be opened whether you like it or not.
I think it's wonderful. And in fact, there are some wonderful bits of dialogue about colonialism, which I won't repeat here because it'll ruin the film for you. But yes, there is this idea that if left alone, Wakanda being left alone, being isolated. And there's also comments about not taking in immigrants as well, you know. So it's not all, you know, oh, you bad colonial people. It's also, we've got our walls up and you're not going to come in here. There is an aspect of the fact that they've got a lot of resources and a lot of intellect. And over millennia, they have developed this. And yes, it is refreshing. And it is... It fits the story. And I think it is going to open people's eyes. But like I said, I think we're getting to the point, thank heavens, where if you're a woman or if you're not white, it's okay. We're not going to go, wow, you know, that's weird. That couldn't possibly happen. Mm. Of course it could happen. It's happening right now in front of the big screen, right in front of you.
Mm. A complex argument wrapped in a popcorn film.
There you go. That's about it.
Black Panther is out now. Okay, well, let's finish up back on the stage. This time we're back at the Wyndham Theatre, where Pulitzer Prize-winning play Long Day's Journey Into Night is currently playing. Written by Eugene O'Neill in the early 1940s, this play is semi-autobiographical, and O'Neill didn't want it performed until after he'd died. Dominic, set up the story for Long Day's Journey Into Night.
Well, you know what? It's very hard to describe this play without making it sound like an utter grind.
Uh-oh.
It's 3.5 hours long. It's set, as the title suggests, over one long summer day. I think it's in 1912. It's about a family who all are doomed or unhappy in one way or another. The mother is addicted to morphine. The father is an actor who considers himself a failure. One son is also an actor and is a big drinker and doesn't see how where his life is going to go. The other son has tuberculosis. He's a sort of poetic type. He's the author character, effectively. And they just talk and talk and talk and talk and talk and talk for 3.5 hours. And this production reminds us it is one of the great masterpieces of 20th century theatre.
Okay, so I know...
I've given you the bad stuff so far. We'll get on to the good stuff.
So I have no problem with these sorts of productions that are designed to be very, very long, harrowing, difficult to watch. Mm. But the trick can be being all of those things, but also making you want to watch.
Yeah.
And a lot of plays can really fall off a cliff when they don't get the second part right.
Mm.
How does this one come across?
Blimey, genius, really. I mean, you look at the structure and you think, how does that work? He just unspools so much. But I tell you what, there is a lot of misery in this, but there's crucially, and this is one thing that Richard Eyre's revival brings out very well, there's a lot of love in there. You don't, it's not, he says in the programme, he's quite right, you don't come out going, oh God, we're all doomed, we're all going to die. It's sort of, it is bathed in a kind of mutual tolerance as well as a mutual impatience, and everyone's awful truths come out. But this is a family, and Jeremy Irons goes around shouting at his sons one moment, and then the next moment, he's hugging them. And that's one of the really good things here. It does feel like a real family, and with your family, oh God, you hate them one moment, you love them the next, and oh, it's time for dinner.
So I think a lot of this can really depend on who is in charge of telling the story here. And in this case, it might be the magic of the text at hand. It might be the direction. For you, where does it sit? Who's driving us to want to go and actually see this?
Ooh, well, I think the great thing is you don't really think of it being directed. You just think of it, okay, you're doing there, you're saying this is real. Leslie Manville, who is, I'm sure Karen will agree, is one of the great sort of purveyors of pain in the world. I'm doing it again. I'm settling down again. She is amazing. The way she's like an open wound, the way she opens up this woman's fury and pain, but fondness as well for the family. And she just powers it along. I saw the production 2 years ago when it first started at Bristol, and Jeremy Irons was definitely lagging behind there. This time, there are issues with his American accent. His consonants, no problem with his consonants. His vowels sort of hurtle back to the British Isles. But much more importantly, he has this character now. He knows this character now. He's an angry man, an impatient man, a mean man, but not a bad man. A sort of a man with a lot of love to give, and even if it's been a bit curdled. But then the play, brilliant. The play makes people act monstrously, but then lets you know why, and we find out about his relationship with his father and all that.
How does the pacing work? Because you mentioned it's 3.5 hours. That is a fair slog, especially when you're sitting in a little theatre seat.
It's one of those, I think, for about the first half hour, there's a lot of talking, a lot of very loud, busy talk, and you think, okay, yeah, where are we going to go with this? And then it just slots into this very argumentative pace, and I think it would have to be... I don't think the British version of this would work in the same way, because I think we don't have that sort of ease with our easy temper about us. I think the Russian version or the American version maybe. There is something about how upfront they are all with each other and how articulate they are as well that just sort of makes it hover a couple of inches above the ground, even though they're giving us so much pain and regret and rancor.
I'm still trying to imagine Jeremy Irons with an American accent. For some reason, I can't make that work inside my head. We mentioned that this play originally wasn't intended to be staged until 25 years after the writer's death. What was the thinking behind that, and how does that actually play into the text itself?
It's close to home. I mean, like I say, the tuberculosis-ridden son, younger son, is kind of an author figure. O'Neill's father was indeed an actor who went around arguably sort of selling his talent short by working this very lucrative one-man show he went around doing. And I guess you get the sense, even if you don't know, you get the sense of something very, very close to home being said. Something like I said before, you know, you don't know quite how this show manages to work. And there is just something, even for O'Neill, who was a great writer, but this is sort of a couple of notches above anything else he did, because there is something that just seems to pour out of these people's souls. And I know that's a little bit lofty to say that, but you know what that means when you see it. It's not quite like anything else for the flow of it.
Mm. Long Day's Journey into Night is at Wyndham's Theatre in London until April 7th, and we'll head to Brooklyn and Beverly Hills this summer. Karen and Dominic, thank you very much for taking us through the stage and screen this week. Now stay there, because a few years ago, writer Daniel Spicer received a commission from The Wire magazine to write a feature about 70s psychedelic Turkish music. This sparked a fascination in the forgotten story of the scene, also known as Anadolu Psych, so much so that Spicer decided to write a book about it. The movement happened with a backdrop of cultural and political turmoil, and after a right-wing coup in 1980, it was brought to an end, but its influences still permeate Turkish music. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke to Daniel about his book, The Turkish Psychedelic Music Explosion, Anadolu Psych, 1965 to 1980.
Really, it was a hybrid music in many ways, because the whole thrust behind it was Turkish musicians who were embracing Western sounds. So that was funk and progressive rock and acid rock and psychedelic rock and all these things. And what they were doing was they were bringing their own music, their own Turkish music, into the mix. So they were incorporating Turkish folk music. And that means Turkish folk music instruments like the saz and the baglama and things like that, and different types of drum, and also incorporating different time signatures from Turkish folk music and different tunings. So there's lots of microtonal tunings, which sound slightly out of tune sometimes to Western ears. But in almost every other part of the world, that's a normal way of making music. And they were folding all these things together and coming up with a music that was very modern sounding, but also at the same time very ancient sounding.
How big was this type of music in Turkey during this period? You know, especially we're going to talk why did it end, but was it quite big, like among young people in Istanbul or the major Turkish cities?
Well, when it started, really, I would say this particular part of it, the psychedelic side of it, I would say kicked off sort of around about 1968, really, although I go a little bit earlier than that in the book. But when they started off, these were sort of underground musicians, really, in lots of ways. But as the 70s wore on, they became big stars in Turkey, and they were playing huge concerts, they were having smash hits, number one singles, and Barış Manço, one of the main stars of the scene, even made movies and went on to become a television star in his own country. So they were huge. But outside of Turkey, pretty much unknown.
Well, one of those artists, in fact, is coming to perform here in London over the weekend. Her name is Sauda. I did listen to a couple of tracks. Actually, we have a short clip which we're going to play here, and then we can talk a little bit more about Sauda. Yes, yes, gazeteci, yes. I really enjoyed.
Yeah.
Tell us more about Sauda.
Well, she was kind of amazing, and still is, actually. As you say, she's performing at the weekend. She was pretty much the only female artist out of the whole scene. It was a very patriarchal, male-heavy scene, but she stood out for a number of reasons. First, she was a woman, and secondly, she was extremely politically outspoken. So the whole time that all this stuff was happening in Turkey, there was a lot of political and social turmoil with left-wing groups and right-wing groups fighting in the streets, and a lot of unease and trouble in the streets, really. And Sauda spoke out for the people against quite a repressive right-wing government, and she became sort of a folk hero in many ways, and she paid the price for that as well. She was harassed by the establishment, she was arrested a few times, she went to prison, and she was blacklisted from being broadcast, and she had her passport taken away, and she stayed strong, she carried on, and out of all of them, she's probably the one that's still going now. So, you know, there's a lesson to be learned in perseverance there.
That's fantastic. Besides Sauda, which other artists? For example, there was a chapter about a very interesting persona, Erkin Koray.
Erkin Koray was an amazing guitarist and composer who was probably one of the most psychedelic of the whole scene, in that he was more sort of affected by, say, people like Jimi Hendrix or Cream, those kind of 60s guitar-based sort of acid rock groups. And he was very far out for the time, had long hair, which was unusual. He would get into fights in the street because people didn't like the way he looked. Again, very outspoken guy, but kind of mystical as well. His music, he didn't really approach the politics in the way that Seldar and other artists did. And he created a great record called Electronic Tokula, which is means electronic ballads or folk songs, in which he reinterpreted some ancient Turkish folk tunes in a very psychedelic way.
In some ways, the politics killed this movement in a way.
As I say, throughout this whole period, there was a sort of tug of war to and fro between different forces in society. And before this period, there had also been a history of coups where the military would take over and depose the government and sort of start all over again. And it hadn't quite killed off everything that was happening with the music. But in 1980, there was a very repressive, very harsh military coup, and a very right-wing government took over, who basically just outlawed and banned and forbade the entire scene by a number of ways of doing it, which was they started really hassling out a lot of the artists. Seldar's one example. Also Cem Karaca, who was another very outspoken singer, who actually fled to Germany and stayed there. So they made it impossible for these artists to carry on with what they were doing. And at the same time, tastes changed. So, you know, as the 70s moved into the 80s, these kind of long-haired rockers became slightly out of fashion, and it was moved into sort of new wave and synth music, and they kind of got left behind. But because they were sort of stamped out, almost airbrushed out of history, they kind of got forgotten.
Do you think, you know, with Seldar playing here in London, can you have a certain resurgence?
It has been becoming better known in the last few years through a number of reasons. It's been sampled by a few really influential people. So Seldar's been sampled by Mos Def and Dr. Dre, and all sorts of other people have picked up on these amazing grooves, like in that little clip we just heard. And they've been sampled. Also, some of them have been carrying on. So Seldar's playing with an Israeli surf rock band called Boompan, who are all young people who've picked up on her music and have carried on the legacy. And there have been a few interesting record labels that have started to re-release some of these records on vinyl as well, so you can pick them up now where before they were extremely rare, but now you can get them quite easily.
When I'm not sure, but when you're doing research for the book, have you been to Turkey as well?
I went to Istanbul, yeah, and had a fantastic time, made some friends, had a good adventure, and did some interesting interviews. Yeah,
I wonder if there's still some night outs of Turkish psychedelic if you go to Istanbul.
Not so much. I mean, there are some groups these days who have picked up on that sound. So there's a very famous group in Turkey called Baba Zula, who started in the 90s, who have incorporated some of this music. And there are some other groups as well who have picked up on some of it. But it's quite underground, alternative, I suppose, similar to what we would call indie music here or would have done some years ago when that still meant something.
That was Daniel Spicer, author of The Turkish Psychedelic Music Explosion, Anadolu Psych, 65-80, which is out now, published by Repeatum. Seldar will be performing at Coco in London this Sunday. Tickets are available online. Now it's time for this week's Global Countdown. Fernando has popped into the studio. Hello, Faye. Now, after all that Turkish music, where else will you be taking us?
It was very interesting. I didn't know before I did this interview that there was a big scene on the Turkish psychedelic scene, but there was. So
From the music that I've heard from some of the Turkish people that I know, it does not surprise me at all.
And there's a bit of synth there, which you're going to see in the country I chose today as well, which is Japan, which is a very strong chart as well. And you know, this is still a country where people still are buying, consuming a lot of music. And just a little warning here, number 5 and number 4, they're kind of connected, because I have to explain to you guys, because there's something in Japan called, it's a girl group called AKB48, and they have 130 members. But off this group,
130?
Yes. It's
what?
Not like a
big stage.
It's an awfully big stage.
And
no shopping mall performances for them.
You mentioned stage. So basically that was the whole idea of the producer of this band, that they would perform on a stage every single day. So I have a feeling that some of them, they might be like, okay, I'll do it tomorrow. So that's why they have 130, I guess. But one thing that I was surprised, they have a lot of sub-branches of the group. And two of those those sub-branches. They're number 5 and number 4. The first, and by the way, they describe themselves as bubblegum pop and synchronized dancing, as you could imagine.
Mm, now, I can well imagine, yes.
Yeah, so we start with the number 5.
Please.
It's NMB48, and the name of the song is Walota People, and we do have a Japanese Shin, our colleague here at Monocle, but he said it doesn't make sense, the title, so I presume it's an invented name, but in English it's Walota People. Shall we listen to it?
Let's hear it. I have to say, I'm just as confused as our friend Shin.
Am I crazy or are they... Or they were singing a lot of people, right?
I could hear it. Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure if you just put that idea in my head, but...
It just makes me want to buy something, but I don't know what.
Yeah, it has that feeling, doesn't it? It
does.
Almost felt like one of those TV ads for the polyphonic ringtones that you used to get back in the early 2000s.
Exactly. And another thing I was thinking is that if they did branch out into subgroups, are they fighting over material like Madonna would? You know, like, that was my song.
there is, because I have to say, there's been quite a... lot of controversies with those groups, but there's been so many of them that it's kind of complicated, because, as I said, you know, there's more than 10 sub-branches of AKB48, and this one, from what I know, they've been together since 2011. Number 4 is a more recent one, since March 2017, so it's a slightly younger version, I would say, and this time it's STU48, and we have a proper title for this one, Darkness. Shall we listen to it?
Let's hear it. It almost sounds like the theme tune to a soap opera of the 1990s.
That sounds good to me.
Yes, it's really, yes.
Because I think probably we want a little bit of a rockier vibe now, right? So it's another Japanese girl group. I mean, it's still fairly poppy and, you know, a lot of dancing in the video. But there is a tiny bit of rock and hip-hop in it. I hope you notice. It's a band called Pimps. They're also from Japan. And the song's called Life is a Game / My Soul.
Yeah, I don't mind that at all, actually, Fernando.
Yeah, it's quite cool. It's not very gritty, you know.
Not too. I would not describe that as gritty, not even remotely.
Well, but wait until you see the number one, because that's definitely not gritty at all. And but moving on to the top two of the Japanese chart, the most interesting thing for me is that actually the artists of the top two, they're not actually Japanese. They're both South Korean. So, you know, a lot of South Korean artists, they do very, very well in Japan. In fact, the number one bands, they are touring Japan at the moment. But we start with number two. Let's not go ahead. It's the boy band, which I will talk about then after we hear the song. It's B1A4, Do You Remember?
It's almost orchestral.
It is.
I have to say, I quite liked that.
It's a very cute ballad. They've been going on again since 2011. And you know how they're well known in South Korea, and I believe in Japan as well, is the countryside idols, because all the members of the band, they come from the countryside. Aww. So that's very cute, singing ballads from the countryside. I think they... But, you know, but I think especially young girls, they love this band. Yeah, I think it's a cute song.
Do you remember me? No, I don't. And I don't remember my Japanese either, for that matter. But no, it worries me that everybody's so sort of middle of the road, kind of, you know what I mean? It just seems so bland and easygoing. It just cuts. There's no bite to it.
There's just no pleasing Karen Krasanovich, is there?
No, and by the way, I think a lot of people like this middle of the roadness because they are actually quite big in the US and Brazil as well.
It doesn't surprise me.
It's interesting because, you know, I don't know exactly all the bands, but in the Hot 100 in the US and Canada, some K-pop bands are starting to enter because they always had this niche, but I think finally they're actually entering the proper pop singles chart.
Well,
actually,
speaking of middle of the road, I think I should point out to everyone in the studio today that there's no Ed Sheeran on this list.
Good point.
Not one Ed Sheeran song, which I think it's the first show I've done in a little while where I haven't had to talk about Ed Sheeran at all.
Well, Ben, and also the efforts, you know, me and our lovely producer Holly, we were trying to say, let's avoid Ed Sheeran, because I think we mentioned his name a million times in 2017, even though it's my job. If he releases a new album, sorry guys, I'll have to mention again.
Nothing against Ed, of course. But let's talk about the number one, Fernando, because this is actually a band that I am familiar with.
Yeah, and I must say before we listen, that I don't think is middle of the road, because that's actually so extremely pop, candy, floss, bubble gum, that even the title of the song is called Candy Pop. and it's a band from South Korea called Twice. I think we should hear it.
Let's hear it.
It's on your face.
I've just been watching Dominic Maxwell write all those notes furiously down. I can tell he's going to run home and Spotify all of this.
Yes, that's right.
It's breaking records.
It's got no air in it, any of this stuff, has it? I feel old. It's got no air. It's sort of middle of the road, like the stuff that was on top of the Pops when I was 15 or younger than that, but with all the air sucked out of it.
Your hair and pigtails, that's how that one works.
That's how they show in the video as well.
I think both of these reasons for not liking the tracks today seem to be Fernando's reasons for actually really, really loving them.
Well, and may I say, they broke a record.
I think they
have the best first week sales of a K-pop girl band in Japan. Here you go.
They also sound like they'd be fine played on your phone, played out, you know, without headphones on you. We're listening on quite nice headphones here, and they sound exactly as if someone was just playing it on their phone.
Exactly. And I have to say, even if you watch the video, which, you know, videos are very expensive, you know, they are dressed as candy pop, as you can imagine, and there's a lot of anime in the video as well. So I mean, for those who enjoy that, I in fact is my favorite song of the top five here.
I would have to say number two is my favorite, to be honest.
Yeah, number two. I could learn Japanese to that one. Also, I'm just fascinated by what do they sound like when you slow them down.
Now we're getting experimental.
Maybe mix that with Turkish psychedelic songs.
Well, if you'd like to hear any of those songs again, I have no doubt whatsoever they'll be making their way onto the Monocle 24 playlist. But sadly, that brings us to the end of today's program. Thanks very much to my guests today, Karen Krasanovich, Dominic Maxwell, and of course, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. This show was produced by Holly Fisher. I'm Ben Ryland. We'll be back at the same time next week. But for now, let's play out with some more of that Japanese number one, Candy Pop. Thanks for listening.
Hey, sweetie, sweetie. Sweetie, sweetie. So, 退屈な everyday. だけど、突然君の